Welcome to the Conversation of Money podcast. This is the weekly show where we talk about all things money and finance, and where we give you information to help you make the best financial decisions possible. So if you want to buy your first home, you want to be better with money, you want to learn how to invest, where to begin, this is the show for you. I'm your host, Peter Komalafe. I'm so thrilled to have you here. So without further ado, let's get going with this week's show. Hey guys, it's Pete. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Last week, we had Marcus Jolly on the show and we had a lengthy conversation about property. And this week is going to be a continuation of that conversation. But we're going to get into the nitty-gritty for the guys who are looking at property investment as something that they really want to get into. There's a wealth of knowledge that Marcus brings with him that we're going to get in today. So I wanted to welcome back Marcus. Welcome.
Thank you, Pierre. Great to be here again.
Good to have you back. I know that last week we kind of got carried away talking about stuff and we didn't really hit all of the points that we wanted to hit. So I thought it only right that we actually have this conversation this week where we talk about some of the real things that people need to know in terms of getting into property. And I know that there's a wealth of stuff that you want to share to empower people as well.
Yeah, definitely. Probably be my fault we didn't get through our audio info last time. Famous leaveable, so I'll try to keep it succinct.
I always say a good conversation is a good conversation, and I'm sure people would have got some value out of the episode last week anyway. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I know that you wanted to share. And the first bit was, we talked last week about making sure that you had, obviously, your goals if you're trying to get into property and stuff. So for someone who has decided, right, I know what my goal is, I definitely wanted to get into property, what's the best place for them to start? Where is it? Where's the best place for them to start?
So there's a couple of schools of thought with this. My opinion is, okay, so you've obviously got the challenge around barriers to entry, which is deposit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So either whether it's 5% or 25%, wherever it might be, you've got a deposit requirement you need to meet. That's a bit separate to the purchasing process or getting started in investing, because mm-hmm. that needs to be done anyway. And that's stuff you can do independently of everything else.
Yep.
Obviously, whilst you're building up your deposit, you want to be making sure that you're addressing anything on your credit file that might be beneficial for you or whatever it might be. One of the first things I'd suggest is speaking to a competent mortgage broker. Mm-hmm. I did mention some of this on last week, but a competent mortgage broker is obviously going to be able to advise you on which products would be available to you with mm-hmm. your circumstances, your earning capacity, your debt to asset ratio and mm-hmm. your whole credit file. And that will help inform decisions around what's achievable, what's not achievable. It's all well and good having, I don't know, a 50% deposit, but if there's only particular products that are available to you or particular lenders that will lend to you, then
yeah, sure.
You're limited. So that's one of the first things. Location, it comes as part of the goal setting, I think. So you've decided you want to go down a cash flow route or capital growth route. Location is going to be influenced around that initial goal setting. So mm-hmm. goal setting, again, important. Once you've identified a location, and this may or may not be in your area, one of the points I always say to people is that it's all well and good investing round the corner from your house or around the corner from your parents or where you went to school or whatever, because you know the area. Mm. Yeah, you know in the area is extremely useful, but it's very unlikely that where you live or where you grew up is the best area in the UK for investing.
Very unlikely. Sure. Yep.
If your play goal strategy is a cash flow strategy and you live in London, then it can be quite difficult as opposed to going up to the north of England. So
yeah, sure.
That's extremely important. But once you've done that, you've identified your location, you said, or a couple of locations, the first thing then would be to engage with local agents and develop your local knowledge. That's one of the first things, particularly if it's not in the area that you know or familiar with. And that is buying minimum three agents that I recommend.
Okay. Why three?
it's just, I think two is not enough. Three, okay. You got good cross-reference. You can cross-reference opinions. And the more, the better. I mean, if you can engage with as many as you want. But I'd say stick to three. It's an easy number to do. You know, three agents within a particular area, you should have relatively good coverage around information, market information in that particular area. And you want to develop that relationship. You obviously want to instruct them and say, look, I've got a budget of this. This is the type of property I'm looking for. I'd always give a much wider remit with regards to above your budget and below your budget.
Okay.
Because again, we'll talk about this when we get to offers, but it might be a scenario where your budget's, I don't know, 180 K for a property, and you tell the agent, my budget's 180. What about that 200K property for that rebate estate that then the family is extremely motivated to sell, that you might be able to get? I'd open it up a bit. And then develop the relationship. So you go on your viewings. You need to do as many viewings as possible. I can't emphasize this enough. And I know it's difficult if you're working a full-time job. I've experienced that. But agents do open on weekends or Saturdays and also evenings as well, depending on, again, going back to the relationship and developing that relationship. If you develop the relationship, there's likelihood is you might be able to get an agent out at 6 p.m. as opposed to closing at 5:30. So, again, it comes back to the relationship. And then you do your viewings and you develop an understanding of the market. And then you can start to put in offers. Now, with regards to putting in offers, you obviously know what your limit is because you've spoken to your mortgage broker. You may or may not have an agreement in principle. In my view, it's not essential at that point to have one. If the agent requests one, then you're in a bit of trouble unless you can develop a relationship to a point where you can circumnavigate that and you can come across as convincing and some conviction. Then you can start to put in offers. Now, I'd always recommend you put in, especially when you're starting in a particular area, as under market value as physically possible, be cheeky.
Okay.
And if the agent turns around and says, oh, nah, that's silly because you're offering, I don't know, 100 grand on a property that's marketed at 150 grand, you turn around and say to the agent, has that person had any offers? The agent turns around and says, no. So, okay, well, how long has it been on the market? Agent says it's been on 6 months, then you can say, well, actually, agent, I'd like you to put this offer forward, and they do have to put your offer forward.
Right, okay.
That's what I'd do. And then,
Marcus, would you say that there's a sweet spot in terms of where you should kind of bid in a situation where property is 150,000, but it hasn't been on the market for maybe 6 months? Mm-hmm. But you want to get under that market value. Is there a sweet spot? Is it 10%, 15%? Is there a number?
Everybody says this and they say, oh, yeah, well, you should be going for minimum 25% under market value. The question is, what's market value? Mm-hmm. And are all properties advertised at market value? Is there that market value they put on the advert market value? Mm-hmm. Or is it just what the sellers told them they want for the property?
Yeah.
So it's very different being on a market value for a true market value and then saying you're getting it 10% under market value compared to something that's 10% over market value advertised and getting it at 10%. You'd still feel like you're getting a deal.
Yeah.
One scenario, you're not getting a deal. One scenario, you are.
So I suppose it's really important to make sure that you do your research on that in the area as well so that you're informed enough to know, well, actually, the property is on the market for more than market value. So you can kind of play your situation as you see it.
And that's where really aggressive offers come into play, because if you offer, I don't know, I've offered ridiculous numbers before, but there's nothing wrong with offering 35, 40% under market value. What's wrong with it? Because again, going back to the point, what's advertised as market value might not be true market value.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you're starting out, if every property, if you view 10 properties a week and every property you offer 30% under market value, you've got to be smart about it because you'll piss off the agents if you do that. You'll get to a point where, let's say all of them are being rejected and it's all similar properties, similarly priced.
Mm-hmm.
You can start to get a feel, well, actually, you know what? I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now. I've been doing 10 viewings a week. I've been offering 30% under market value. None of them are coming off. And then you add that onto speaking with the agents and following up on property sales to find out what the property actually sold for, looking on land registry to say what it's hit land registry for, and then developing an idea, because there's many scenarios that I've had where I'm looking at particular properties and it's all advertised at X figure and then it's all getting sold. And then you actually look back on land registry and you find out all of those properties are going way above the asking prices.
Right, okay.
And then you know that actually what the stuff's being advertised for compared to what it's selling for is different, and it's, and it's selling for more. That means there must be quite a lot of demand, quite a lot of competition with that particular area. And actually offering market value isn't going to get you the property in that area. And actually perhaps might need to offer over what it's advertised at. So really get stuck into the market, engage with the particular professionals in that area that can advise you. And you're looking for a piece of information in every conversation that you have. You're looking for everything you can get to get a true figure of to what the market's like in that area. And so then you can inform your offers moving forward.
Good. So I guess with offers, it's always one of those things. It sounds like a bit of a science to it in terms of you got to go for a little bit of gut, but you also need to have a little bit of knowledge in there as well. And there's a little bit of kind of testing the waters of where everything truly lies. Because I guess ultimately you want a deal in some way, shape or form. And if you don't want, if you don't have to pay over the odds, then, you know, you don't have, you don't want to pay over the odds, I guess, is the, is the main crux of the thing.
And it supercharges. So to kind of go back to it, the whole reason why you'd offer under market value is, because you're paying less for a property than your next door neighbor might have paid for it. But that's, it's almost, in terms of the figures that you're going to, generally people are going to get in under market value, it's going to be insignificant, really, over the course of a 25-year, 35-year mortgage, if you've got it for $5,000 cheaper or $10,000 cheaper than your next door neighbor. The real benefit is going to be when you come to a position where your fixed period ends and you might, and you might have added some value on top of that, and you want to remortgage and pull some equity out. That 5% under market value that you got when you offered
makes a huge 10% difference.
Is going to make a huge difference to how much you can then pull out. So that then helps you then supercharge your further purchases. So that, that's why understanding what market value is and true market value in the area, getting stuck in is so important, because it can have massive benefits to your long-term property journey. But as well, caveat that with, be also don't beat yourself up trying to get 30% under market value on every, because it, in most circumstances, that is extremely aggressive.
Have you ever had situations where you've put an offer in on a property and you're just getting like a no, and there is a number that they want the house for? Is it easy to get that out of the lesson agents or the agent in question?
They're, ultimately, they are salespeople. Their goal is to, they're target-driven employees. They have targets that they sit down on a Monday morning. I don't know how it works in that world, but I assume we've got all sales jobs. You have weekly meetings where you sit down and you say, this is your targets. These are the things that we need you to deliver. And they have to go out there and deliver it. That's the priority. So if you work that out for yourself, for how what people's motivations are. And again, perhaps it's a lot of people skills, interpersonal skills and emotional intelligence to be able to work these things out. And then to differentiate between an agent that's started that week compared to one that's been there for a couple of years, 10 years, that's got lots of experience, that really does know the true market value, as opposed to someone who's just saying what they hear about in the office or what they've been told by their manager. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to it, it can be done. If I, any deal that I do, I'll probably know what, early on, what the seller wants or what figure they've got in their head. And that's just a bit of tenacity, I think.
Then last week you spoke a little bit about HMOs and things like that. explain for the listeners who might be sort of green to this, what the different strategies are and when you kind of might actually use them and when they might be useful.
Right. So with regards to strictly property investing, so this is what I define as owning property for the long term. Flips don't come into this necessarily for me, because if you're flipping property, you're buying property, you're doing it up, or maybe you're not doing it up, but you're buying it and then you're selling it for, for a higher price. You're owning a property for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't experience the long-term capital growth, as we mentioned last time. And that is, for me, that's more of a cash flow play. Mm-hmm. It's more higher capital than a regular cash flow, but it's a cash flow play. So in terms of actual property investing, what I would classify is buy-to-lets, which is your vanilla, people call them vanilla buy-to-lets, but that's the core of property investing. Then you've got HMOs, you've got service accommodation, you've got commercial property, you've got other different strategies, creative strategies that people have developed nowadays, things like lease options, which some scenarios it can be classed as investing, because you might have a clause in that agreement to say, look, I want to buy that property after a certain amount of time. And then you are technically buying it. So that couldn't come into there. So buy to let is where you buy a property and then you have a family living there, single family. So there's a single tenancy agreement and it's one household. So they're not have to be a family. Don't have to be related, but have to be one household.
Okay,
so
yeah.
You all have to be on one tenancy agreement, and that's buy to let. That's it. You get tenants in, hold the property, collect the rent, fix any problems. That's it. Nothing else to it. And then just a rent might increase as the markets increase.
Mm-hmm.
HMOs is slightly different. Now, HMOs is house of multiple occupancy or house in multiple occupation. And that's defined as where you've got people from different households. And there's a difference between a HMO and a large HMO, and there's a difference in how it's regulated.
So
for a large HMO, where that's five or more people, you have to have a HMO license.
Right.
Now, for a HMO license, there's an officer that comes out to the property and assesses your fire doors, your emergency lighting, your smoke alarms, things like that. The safety things that you need in place to run a HMO as a professional. Obviously, there's a lot of cowboys out there. But that's a HMO. Serviced accommodation is also known as holiday lets. People more commonly know this as the types of property that you see on Airbnb. That's serviced accommodation, basically. Mm-hmm. So you own a property, and then for periods of time throughout the month, you let it for short term, or it can be long term, to individuals that pay per night, effectively. There's restrictions on that. One thing I will mention in terms of something to avoid, and something that I realized luckily in time, is that there are sometimes restrictions on in the lease agreement for apartments around serviced accommodation. So it will state within your lease agreement, because it's leasehold property, it's not freehold. You don't own the land. If it's a managing agent who owns the land, you might say in that lease agreement that this is property is not to be used as serviced accommodation. And you don't typically get lease agreements or necessarily read through them prior to purchasing the property. You have to request it. It's something you request. And if you don't, and your conveyancer should be going through all this, but if you don't tell your conveyancer your appetite to do a serviced accommodation, they're not going to point it out to you.
Yeah.
And then you're in a situation where you might have ran your numbers based on service accommodation, based on, I don't know, 80% occupancy rate or whatever it might be, you ran your numbers. And actually, they're turning around and telling you can't do service accommodation, so you stop doing it as a buy-to-let.
Yeah.
But maybe the buy-to-let figures don't stack up to what you wanted. But it's things like stress tests and that, which should protect you from that. But it's important to understand and know what you're doing in regards to that. So they're kind of the main property strategies. And then you've got cash flow strategies, such as you rent to rent, you lease options and things like that. You know, the creative options that I don't get involved with.
Okay. I've had a couple of questions in the past where I remember speaking to a guy in Birmingham, actually messaged me, and he got offered the opportunity to invest in some serviced apartments. So put some money in and he would get a yield of X coming out the back of it. What's your thoughts on that approach as an option to invest in property?
Yeah, I mean, that can work. Do you get ownership, though, to get a charge on that particular property? I'd ask that question. How much are you putting into it? And is it worth just buying your property yourself when you're involved with other people? Because I realized this, a new phase, craze in property. I won't create a craze, but it's a new thing in property called build to rent.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard about that. It's quite interesting, actually, because you're getting a lot of pension providers, pension holders or fund managers or whoever it might be, allocating their funds that they're managing, might be pension funds or whatever, with developers to build property for rental. Mm-hmm. So it's purpose-built developments for rental.
Yeah.
Funded by, instead of putting it in the markets, which a lot of them do, they're putting it into property.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know at least firm that allocated a load of money to that personally. And that has been a bit of a trend over the last year that I found.
Yeah.
More and more people getting involved in, because they envisage that as a means to get greater yield. I think the problem to really come into that is when perhaps the build costs escalates over and above what's been budgeted in the first place, because that then reduces their yield. And in this instance, for this provider, they had quite a big shot because the build costs increased quite significantly and reduced their yield quite a bit.
Yeah. And then you've got the and for property investors, it's important to know about these trends, because ultimately that's competition. And and the way that they can go about, if you've got millions of pounds for a particular development and you've got your buy-to-let next door from a development that's 20 years old, and they've come in and they've put in a purpose-built entertainment mixed use at the bottom, you've got gyms and all these facilities, and some new developers are doing even like to implement technology and apps so you can manage your tenancy and all sorts. And you're offering similar price ranges, you're going to struggle. So it's important to understand type of these types of trends.
Yeah. Okay. Are those the main strategies that you're seeing at the moment? Are there any other kind of outliers or new things that you're seeing coming along that perhaps people might need to be aware of?
I think if you're just getting started, I'd just stick to the basics, man. Stick to the basics. Understand what a buy-to-let investment is. But then also, again, you can be adventurous if you're extremely compelled to be aggressive with your investment strategy and you say, I want to go straight into a HMO, then fine. But there's a lot of lessons that you will learn from a humble vanilla buy-to-let. I think it's important to learn if you're going to go be in a long-term property journey.
Yeah. And obviously right now we're in COVID-19 times. So I guess it's safe to say that nothing is normal at this point in time. I mean, you look at the stock market, it's completely divorced to the reality of the economy being shut down for the time that it has been. And I guess property will be impacted in some way, shape, or form. I mean, look, the company's been shut down, so no viewings, nothing's been going on for a few weeks now. What do you feel is the outlook for property here in the UK after all of this is said and done?
I mean, I think anybody that says that they know is lying.
Crystal ball time.
Yeah. So the reality is that nobody knows. This is unprecedented. It's not just the event itself. It's the responses from governments as well. You've got to think about the impacts. You've got to think about mass psychology in terms of how people are interpreting and feeling in this market with what's going on. And again, one of the reasons why I like property, why I invest in property, is because of its fundamentals. And for me personally, from my own analysis, the fundamentals are still there. There is still a supply and demand situation going on with property in the UK. So that will, for me, always help fund and fuel the values. Mm-hmm. But then you look at what the impact that coronavirus has had. Obviously, there's agents shut down, solicitors firms shut down. We had, construction sites shut down, things like that. So that obviously impacted it. I mean, people, there's figures to say there's like 450,000 moves that were put on hold due to coronavirus. So that might or might not present a backlog. You can't automatically say because 450,000 transactions were estimated and it didn't happen, that that's all of a sudden going to kick in on the back end.
I mean, I have a couple of friends who were planning on purchasing houses and selling their houses that now, I spoke to one of them day before yesterday, he's like, that fell through and he's not going to continue with it when it comes back, because he's saying, well, actually, if the property market has fallen, then I'm not going to pay the amount that we agreed in the first for that property. So it's going to start again. And equally, I know people who, off the back of this, aren't really sure whether they're going to have a job or that job security or an income to be able to carry through on the mortgage. So there is a big impact to be considered in that sense.
And even when it comes to things like payment holidays, yeah, the government has introduced this scheme about payment holidays. It was unknown for a large, for an initial period, whether or not that's going to affect your credit score and whether or not lenders are then going to allow you to switch mortgage products if you've taken out a payment holiday. I've heard recently that I think they've announced that you will be able to switch products. I think that's largely due to the fact that I think it's like 1.2 million people have taken out payment holidays, have gone for payment holidays.
Yeah.
So
that was one of the things that I argued when this whole thing kicked off, is that for people who do need to take payment holidays, number one, what happens to your credit score? And largely that is dictated by the mortgage lenders, because they report the information to the credit reference agency.
Right, okay.
So if they were to take the stance of, and I don't know whether they are or whether they're not, this is just speculation, but if they were to take the stance of, well, we are going to report that you missed a payment, then potentially they're blacklisting 1.2 million people who will have remortgages, who want to switch products from doing any business or being able to do anything at all for at least 3-4 years, because it stays on your record for that long. My hope is that they'll do the right thing. And if you've taken a mortgage repayment holiday, it doesn't show up on your credit score. There are no negative, you know, consequences. The reality is, at this point, it's still very much an unanswered question.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one thing that, I mean, even if, so, yeah, there's, I think there's a lot of complex, there's a lot of aspects to this, there's a lot of cogs in this machine about how it plays out. I'm not necessarily sure, but yeah, you've got payment holidays. I don't know how much that amounts to in regards to that figure, that gap, that I don't know if the government's going to plug it or what's going to happen with regards to that. But yeah, in terms of my outlook, things seem to be returning to, well, moving in the right direction, let's say. There's a lot of construction house builders that are back on site. A lot of the key work has continued throughout the lockdown. Projects like HS2 are now continued, reduced levels. But I know like Taylor Wimpey, Barrett Homes, Persimmons, they're announced that they're going back on site shortly. If you look at when the pandemic hit, a lot of mortgage lenders retracted a lot of their products, didn't they? I think over the past couple of weeks, more and more lenders have re-released their products. So their outlook seems quite positive. Obviously agents are opening up again, so people can actually move house. Actually, it's funny, my sister has gone for a move during this whole pandemic period. I asked her this morning, so I'm going on the podcast later, what things have changed for you actually going through the purchasing during this coronavirus situation? And she said, look, my conveyancer was still going into the office.
Wow.
Actually, they've been quicker to come back to me than they had been before. The property was vacant, so there's no real restrictions on that. So some scenarios aren't affected. I think my outlook is, go back to the question, is fundamentals. When you look at any investment, you look at fundamentals, and I think they're still strong. And things like salaries and stuff like that. Yes, there's a lot of people that are unemployed, but salaries in comparison to house prices are still very competitive. When you look mm-hmm. at history and you look at, particularly in the north, it's still competitive. Yeah. So whether or not the house values drop or not, I don't know. But if you're investing for the long term, it shouldn't really matter, should it?
Yeah. No, it shouldn't. Would you say that there is an opportunity at the moment for buyers, for investors, given that obviously the bank rate is so low right now, 0.1%? Do you see that as an opportunity for investors?
I'm not sure how the base rate has affected mortgage products. Because initially, I don't think when the base rate dropped, I don't think lenders necessarily passed on that saving to potential buyers. I'm not sure that it's been reflected in mortgage interest rates. But in regards to actual purchasing and values, I think when any time there's any uncertainty, there's going to be opportunity. Anytime there's any movement at all, there's going to be opportunity. It's about learning how to leverage the situation. I think anybody putting their house on the market now, or anyone that has consistently had their house on the market throughout this pandemic, is someone who needs to sell rather than someone who's selling out of choice.
Yeah.
So I think it's perhaps easier to identify the motivated sellers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people perhaps don't have the insight into the markets or insight into property and investment classes, investment vehicles that perhaps we have, to be able to mm-hmm. say, okay, well, let's step back from this a second. Yes, this has happened. Yes, this has happened. But what does long-term look like? Are the fundamentals still there? Are the reason why I got into property in the first place still there, albeit mm-hmm. a bit disjointed at the moment?
Yeah, sure.
And if so, this little blip shouldn't really sway me too much. So that, yeah, not everybody has that outlook. Some people might think this is the end of the world, end of property, and therefore willing to just kind of get rid of their stock.
I think you made a really good point, though, in the fact that if you are in this for the long term, it's like any other investment. Now doesn't matter. It's a blip. It's a blip in time. And, you know, you fast forward 4 or 5 years from now, hopefully we'll be in a much, much better place and property prices will be as healthy as ever. And mm-hmm. this will be something that you'll remember as something that...
Like 2008.
Like 2008 that happened for a period of time. It might have been painful, might have been a bit surprising, but ultimately had no consequences whatsoever.
And actually, so saying that, think about that. It's not like 2008. 2008 was a house price bubble caused by subprime mortgages.
Yeah.
There was an actual financial element. There's an element in the system.
Yeah, there was a catalyst from the financial system that led to this entire thing, whereas this is, you know, a virus that nobody ever really saw coming along. And this is one thing I have actually been saying, is the fact that people should take confidence in that, in the fact that, yes, everything's ground to a halt. And, yeah, it's terrible right now, and the outlook doesn't seem so rosy right now, but there isn't a catalyst within the financial markets or property markets or any other market for that matter that has kicked this off.
Yeah.
Just from something that we were completely oblivious to back end of last year, and we come around to January, we know it's going to be a little bit of a problem, then we get to February, and it's a huge problem. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even Brexit, I mean, everyone was saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to hang on until after Brexit. I'm going to hang on to that after Brexit. And my outlook was always the fact that Brexit's been spoken about for years now. And everybody knows it's happening. Not everyone, there's a lot of uncertainty around it. But we know, it's been so long that we know this thing, this particular event's happening. Actually, is this event not factored into prices at the mm-hmm. moment prior to it happening? And in my view, it was. Mm-hmm. There was going to be no drop, just because we leave EU, there's going to be no drop off in price, just a sudden collapse.
Yeah.
Everybody already knows about it. It's not a surprise.
Mm.
So really, should you be, so now after Brexit, if you were holding off for Brexit, and then you held off for Brexit, and then coronavirus happened, and now you're hanging off for coronavirus, it's going to be 5 years until you invest in, and someone who took action 5 years ago has now had 5 years worth of capital growth and rental income. So
yeah.
Is that element to it as well?
Perfect. Well, that's fantastic. We covered everything.
I think so. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, Marcus, why don't you tell everybody where they find you again, just in case they do want to reach out?
So my name is Marcus Jolly, so you can catch me on LinkedIn, or you can, well, please do follow the Smart Money Management LTD Instagram page.
Perfect. Excellent. Guys, that's given a lot of information if you are looking at property investments as something that you want to get into. Like I said, this isn't my area of expertise, so it would have been wrong for me to talk about all the stuff. And actually, to be fair, I've learned a ton of stuff just having this conversation with Marcus. So if you do want to reach out to him, I will link all of his details down in the show notes. But again, I hope you found value in that. I hope you found use in that conversation and you've taken a few things away to enrich your knowledge and help you along in your path. But guys, this is another episode of the show. I'm always thankful that you guys listen in, and I really do look forward to bringing you another episode next week. Have a great weekend, and thank you, Marcus, for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.